New York. This is Democracy Now!
Given the blockade that we are subjected to and the situation in the country, it would have been very difficult for us to get the results that we are getting in the fight against the pandemic if we had not developed this industry more than 35 years ago in our country.
As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 tops 560,000 and Brazil records over 4,200 deaths in a single day, we look at how Cuba has successfully fought the pandemic despite the U.S. embargo. Cuba could soon be releasing two new COVID-19 vaccines. It's also sent doctors around the world to help other nations during the pandemic. We'll go to Havana for more. Plus, we speak to the Americas director of Amnesty International about how the pandemic has exacerbated inequality across the hemisphere. Then, as a mass shooting in Rock Hill, South Carolina, leaves five dead, President Biden announces new executive actions to curb gun violence.
Gun violence in this country is an epidemic, and it's an international embarrassment.
That and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our audience, our top story contains graphic footage and descriptions of police violence. In Minneapolis, a medical expert called by the prosecution in former police officer Derek Chauvin's murder trial testified Thursday George Floyd died from a lack of oxygen, not from the drug fentanyl, as alleged by the defense. Pulmonologist Dr. Martin Tobin estimated Floyd's airways were 85% restricted as he was caught in a vise between the hard asphalt and Chauvin's knee for over 9 minutes, face down and handcuffed, repeatedly gasping, "I can't breathe," before falling silent.
At the beginning, you can see he's conscious. You can see slight flickering, and then it disappears. And so one second he's alive, and 1 second he's no longer. That's the moment the life goes out of his body.
Dr. Tobin testified that based on a telltale kick of his leg, George Floyd appeared to suffer brain damage 5 minutes after Chauvin first pressed his knee into Floyd's neck. Dr. Tobin said Chauvin continued to press Floyd into the pavement for more than 3 minutes after Floyd's last breath. In Bryan, Texas, one person was killed and five others wounded Thursday after an employee of a cabinet shop opened fire at his workplace. After the shooting, the suspect led police in a high-speed chase that wounded an officer in a gun battle. The 27-year-old suspect was then taken into custody alive. In South Carolina, a gunman broke into the home of a prominent doctor in the city of Rock Hill Wednesday, killing five people, including children, and wounding a sixth person before turning the gun on himself. Police identified the killer as Philip Adams, a 33-year-old former NFL star who played for the Atlanta Falcons and San Francisco 49ers. Adams had a history of head injuries, including two concussions in a span of three games during the 2012 season. Adams' father said his son had no history of violence, telling reporters, quote, "I can say he's a good kid. I think the football messed him up." President Biden ordered a series of executive actions on gun control Thursday, calling gun violence in the U.S. an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Biden's orders will crack down on so-called ghost guns, easily assembled firearms bought over the internet without serial numbers, which account for about a third of guns recovered at crime scenes. Biden called for an expansion of red flag laws that allow family members or law enforcement to temporarily block people from obtaining firearms if they present a danger. He also called on Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines and said gun manufacturers should be held liable for deaths and injuries resulting from their products.
The only industry in America, a billion-dollar industry, that can't be sued, has exempt from being sued, are gun manufacturers.
The United States recorded nearly 80,000 new coronavirus infections Thursday and 1,000 deaths from COVID-19. Michigan remains the hardest hit state, but new hotspots are emerging in the Northeast, Texas, and parts of the upper Midwest and North Carolina. Health officials shut down a mass vaccination site Thursday after several patients had immediate adverse reactions to shots of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. This follows similar reports of nausea and dizziness in people who received J&J doses in Colorado a day earlier. Johnson & Johnson said Thursday it'll drastically reduce its deliveries of its vaccine around the U.S. next week after one of its contractors, Emergent BioSolutions, said 15 million doses at a Baltimore plant were contaminated and needed to be thrown out. The White House has since ordered Johnson & Johnson to take charge of the plant. One in four U.S. adults is now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. In Pakistan, Prime Minister Imran Khan is being called a rape apologist after he blamed a rise in sexual assault cases on the way women dress and on outside cultural influence. This is human rights activist Tahir Abdullah, who joined a protest in the capital Islamabad this week.
It is highly humiliating and insulting to say that Pakistani men cannot control themselves when women are out in public without wearing the veil. Does that mean that men are out of control and that all men are rapists because they see women not observing the veil in public? This is nonsense. It is a Taliban mindset, and it betrays a sexism, misogyny, and patriarchy. And the Prime Minister must apologize.
President Biden has joined the Irish and British prime ministers in calling for an end to the unrest that's rocked Northern Ireland over the past week. Since last Friday, vehicles have been set on fire and clashes with police have left dozens of officers injured. Police deployed water cannons in Belfast Thursday night and threatened to start shooting plastic bullets. Some of those in the streets have been as young as 12 or 13. The unrest comes amidst mounting anger in unionist or loyalist areas over Brexit, which they say further weakens Northern Ireland's ties to Britain. Britain's Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, has died at the age of 99. Prince Philip fought in World War II, was a stalwart supporter of the British monarchy for over seven decades. In Texas, an investigation is underway into allegations of child abuse, including sexual assault, faced by unaccompanied migrant children being held at the Freeman Expo Center in San Antonio. Over 1,300 unaccompanied teens who recently came to the U.S. seeking refuge are currently being detained at Freeman, according to the latest data. Nearly 19,000 unaccompanied children came to the U.S. during March, double the number of children who arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border in February. In more immigration news, the parents of 445 migrant children separated by the Trump administration still cannot be found. That's according to a court filing from the ACLU, which says efforts to reunite separated refugee families are moving slowly. In more news from Texas, a newly leaked video reveals a Harris County Republican official urged his party to create an army of poll watchers made up of 10,000 people from Houston's majority white suburbs. The unnamed official says the poll watchers should mobilize on Election Day in predominantly black and brown communities in Houston.
We've got to get folks in these suburbs out here that have, a lot of Republican folks that got to have the courage. If we don't do that, you know, this fraud down in here is really going to continue.
The video was published by the government accountability group Common Cause Texas, which warns the efforts could further fuel voter suppression in communities of color. New Mexico's banned qualified immunity for all government workers, including police officers. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed the legislation Wednesday, ending the use of legal protection for which for years has given police officers near immunity from lawsuits and from prosecution in cases of excessive force and other forms of misconduct. This comes after New York City banned qualified immunity for police officers last month. in Bessemer, Alabama, a partial tally of votes cast by workers at an Amazon warehouse shows more than twice as many votes against forming a union than in favor, with around half the cast ballots counted. Hundreds of ballots have been challenged during the count, most of them challenged by Amazon. Those votes could come back into play if the margin among the uncontested ballots is close. Meanwhile, the labor rights media group More Perfect Union has revealed Amazon executives coerced the U.S. Postal Service to install a private mailbox at the Bessemer warehouse so the company could pressure workers to mail their ballots from work and monitor votes. Longtime reporter and author Reese Ehrlich has died after a battle with prostate cancer. He co-authored the best-selling book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. He also published books on U.S. foreign policy in Iran, Cuba, and Syria. In his final column for The Progressive, published just 2 weeks ago, Reese Ehrlich wrote, quote, "I hope I've helped explain some complicated world issues you might not otherwise have understood. I hope the activism earlier in my life and my writing and speeches later have helped bring about progressive change." You can see our interviews with Reese Ehrlich at democracynow.org. And in Nevada, anti-war protesters have been leading peaceful actions outside Creech Air Force Base all week, blocking its gates to protest U.S. drone warfare. On Monday, a vigil was held for Daniel Hale, a former intelligence analyst who pleaded guilty last week to leaking classified documents about the secretive U.S. targeted killing program. He faces up to 10 years in prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 tops 560,000, and Brazil records over 4,200 deaths in a single day, we begin today's show looking at how Cuba has successfully fought the pandemic. Since last year, only about 440 Cubans have died from COVID-19, giving the island one of the lowest death rates per capita in the world. Cuba's also developing five COVID-19 vaccines, including two, which have entered stage three trials. Eduardo Martinez is the president of BioCuba Pharma.
We are very confident that our vaccines will be effective. The vaccines that are being developed, the results that we have had to date point to satisfactory results. And we maintain that before the end of 2021, our population will be immunized with the vaccines that we're developing. Given the blockade that we are subjected to and the situation in the country, it would have been very difficult for us to get the results that we are getting in the fight against the pandemic if we had not developed this industry more than 35 years ago in our country.
For decades, Cuba has heavily invested in its medical and pharmaceutical system, in part because of the six-decade-old U.S. embargo that's made it harder for Cuba to import equipment and raw materials from other countries. In the 1980s, Cuba developed the world's first meningitis B vaccine. It's also developed important cancer drugs that are now being used in the United States and elsewhere. In a moment, we'll go to Havana. But first, I want to turn to an excerpt from the recent online documentary series, The War on Cuba, produced by Belly of the Beast, an independent media group in Cuba. One episode looks at Cuba's efforts to fight COVID-19 at home and abroad. It's narrated by the Cuban journalist Liz Oliva Hernandez.
Every morning, tens of thousands of doctors, nurses, and medical students take to the streets across Cuba. They are on the front lines of our fight against COVID. Talia Ruiz is a first-year medical student.
I don't feel afraid. If we are careful and take the necessary measures, we won't get infected. There are doctors who have faced the disease head-on, and they haven't gotten sick. For example, my dad. Hi, Dad.
Talia's father, Juan Jesus, is a family doctor who works at a small clinic next to their home. In March, he joined a group of Cuban doctors on a medical mission to Lombardy, Italy. At the time, Lombardy was the global epicenter of the pandemic.
The number of cases overwhelmed the health system there. We helped the medical personnel who could no longer handle so many cases, and we saved some lives. As we walked to the farewell ceremony, from every home, people came out and applauded us. It was the best feeling I've had in my life. That's why you go on missions.
It wasn't the first time Juan Jesus risked his life far from home. He's part of the Henry Reeve Brigade, Cuba's medical special forces.
Henry Reeve was a soldier from the United States who fought for Cuba against the Spanish in the 1868 war. The brigade was formed in 2005. A hurricane called Katrina destroyed New Orleans. There was a huge number of deaths. Cuba offered to send 100 doctors to work alongside U.S. doctors. We were ready to go.
George W. Bush rejected Cuba's offer to help New Orleans. Since then, Juan Jesus has treated survivors of natural disasters and epidemics around the world.
That's an excerpt from the video series The War on Cuba, which was produced by Belly of the Beast, an independent media organization in Cuba founded by journalist Reed Lindsay, who joins us from Havana, where we're also joined by Dr. Rolando Perez Rodriguez, the director of science and innovation at BioCuba Pharma, which oversees Cuba's medicine development, including the development of COVID-19 vaccines. He's also the founder of Cuba's Molecular Immunology Center and a member of the Cuban Academy of Science. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Rolando Perez Rodriguez, why don't you talk about the latest vaccines, two of which are in trial three. Soberano Dos is one of them.
Good morning. I would like to thank you for this invitation to share with you our experience in facing COVID-19 pandemics. I have to say that we have the first case of COVID-19 in Cuba was reported on March 11, 2021. And in April this year, we decided to start this COVID vaccine project, a different several vaccine a COVID-19 vaccine project. And in August 13, we already got the first approval to start a phase one clinical trial with the first vaccine candidate. So in very short time, we succeed to get to clinical development of this candidate vaccine. Today, we have, as you said, five different vaccine candidate in clinical development, two of them in phase three clinical trials. Three of these. All of these candidate vaccine used as antigen the receptor binding domain of the spike protein that which bind to the cell receptor. So this antigen is expressed in different technology platform. Three of the vaccine use the recombinant protein produced in mammalian cells, and the other two in yeast. But all of these vaccine we are developing now, we use a platform technology that are very safe, are sub-unit vaccines. We all the formulation also benefit from all the technology we have used in Cuba for a previous prophylactic vaccine. So are very safe. We have long experience with this kind of technologies. And that's the reason we can't really go so fast to clinical development.
Cuba will be the first country in Latin America to develop vaccines, this despite the U.S. embargo. Can you talk about how why you think Cuba is so far ahead?
No, I had to say that we in Cuba we make a huge investment, you know, in biotechnology last century. By the 80s of last century, we start developing a biotech industry so early, maybe. And then in combination with a healthcare system that, you know, is free, is universal, full coverage, and this combination of a biotech industry and a good a primary care system. I think that that combination made possible to accelerate or have impact of all these biotech products in the healthcare and provide us the experience and the capacity to make so fast development of this vaccine project and to introduce in the healthcare system.
Why do you think Cuba has far surpassed the United States when it comes to COVID-19 and people surviving? I mean, the U.S., I mean, per capita, I think Cuba has something like over the year between 40 and 60 times less the death toll per capita than the United States. How is this possible with the U.S. being the wealthiest country in the world and in the U.S. imposing this massive embargo against Cuba, which is not only stopping U.S. Support for Cuba, but countries around the world?
No, you know, it's what I tried to explain before. That is a combination of a national pharmaceutical, biopharmaceutical industry, but also how we organize the healthcare system in Cuba. That is free, universal, full coverage, with access to all the population, and also this health primary care system that is looking for, you know, to for people with disease. So we are not expecting the people come to the healthcare system. We are looking for the people. So it's a very active and preventive approach to the healthcare. And I think that this kind of organization made possible that with not so much resources, you can have a big impact on healthcare. That is the reason might be the way we organize all this healthcare system.
I wanted to bring journalist Reed Lindsay into this conversation, who has put out this series, founder of Belly of Beast, called The War on Cuba. If you can talk about overall during the time of COVID, even beyond the vaccines, what Cuba has done, what you document in your film series, like sending doctors to places like Brazil, Bolivia, Ecuador, and beyond.
You know, thanks a lot, Amy. You know, I was in Haiti for 5 years, and that was my first direct experience with the Cuban doctors, and I found it remarkable what the Cuban program in Haiti was doing. It wasn't only bringing Cuban doctors to work in the poorest areas of Haiti; it was also training Haitian doctors in Cuba. And Cuba at that time was graduating more doctors than the public universities in Haiti. And they were returning to Haiti and working there. And in a sense, it was brain drain in reverse. And living here in Cuba, you know, my doctor is just a block or two away. If I have any problem, I walk down there. It's free. I don't have to show any papers. And that's what it's like for healthcare. It can be a little shocking not having to go in and fill out forms and showing your insurance and everything. And of course, when COVID hit, I knew that Cuba would be prepared, and I felt safer here, frankly, a lot safer than I did if I had been in the United States. I remember telling my mom, who's often been worried about different places I've been in around the world, I told her now I was more worried about her than she was about me.
I want to turn to another excerpt from your film, The War on Cuba, about Brazil's far-right president Jair Bolsonaro expelling thousands of Cuban doctors in 2018.
Bolsonaro has always followed the U.S. president. They call him the Latino Trump. The U.S. wants to cut off the income, to choke the Cuban economy, to try to bring about a political change here on the island. When Cuba left the program, around 1,700 municipalities were suddenly left without doctors. I had a patient in Brazil, a 70-year-old man, illiterate. He made an appointment so he could say goodbye. He cried right here on my shoulder.
Millions of Brazilians in poor communities were left without health care. It was just the beginning. Ecuador's president became a Trump ally. And then, in November 2019, he expelled hundreds of Cuban doctors. That same month, a U.S.-supported coup ousted Bolivian President Evo Morales. Bolivia's de facto government immediately took aim at the Cuban doctors.
The false Cuban doctors. They said we weren't doctors. They accused us of being criminals.
Joan Dramuro was head of the Cuban medical mission in Bolivia.
They threatened to burn down the Cuban doctors' homes. They took others to Interpol. They pointed guns at two brigade members. These troops searched some of our women.
That an excerpt from The War on Cuba. Reed Lindsay, a founder of the Belly of the Beast production that made this series. Now, this is very interesting, what's happening in Brazil. And if you can talk about the effects of this. I mean, we just reported that 4,200 people died in Brazil just yesterday. That's over 10 times the number of Cubans who've died in during the entire pandemic.
Yeah, it's, you know, and in doing this, this series, we spoke with numerous doctors who were part of Cuban doctors who were in Brazil, and they were hurting because they knew that these communities that they were helping, they weren't able to help, and that they were suffering. People were dying of COVID. What that was part of Trump's policies to crush the Cuban economy, because Cuba sends doctors to other parts of the world. Like Haiti, there are many cases where there's really no evidence it's anything but altruistic, but it also sends doctors to places like Brazil, and Cuba receives some money for that, and they use that money to subsidize healthcare in Cuba, and so the Trump administration went after these programs to try to basically hurt the Cuban economy, and it wasn't the only thing they've done. What's really remarkable about the vaccines and what Cuba's achieved in the last year is that Cuba right now is undergoing a severe economic crisis. And in part, it's because of COVID. Obviously, there's no more tourism, and Cuba depended greatly on tourism for its economy. But even before then, there were people who were comparing the economic situation in Cuba to the special period after the fall of the Soviet Union, which was considered worse than the Great Depression. And the reason was because of U.S. sanctions. Now, the embargo's been around for decades, but under Trump, those sanctions became far, far worse. And, you know, that's really the story we were trying to tell with the war in Cuba. And I feel it's important to point out that this is a project. What's really unique about Belly of the Beast, and I'm very proud of being a part of it, is that it is a collaboration between U.S. journalists and filmmakers and Cuban journalists and filmmakers. Most of the people in Belly of the Beast are young Cuban journalists and filmmakers. They're telling stories about U.S. intervention in Cuba for a young audience in the United States. And we feel that's really important because people in the United States are at the forefront of pushing for change and policy in the U.S., but they don't always get information about the impact of U.S. policy in other parts of the world, such as Cuba. Not only how that policy is affecting Cubans, but also how that policy affects people in the U.S. And you cited an example earlier. Cuba produces life-saving drugs that cannot be obtained in the United States because of the U.S. embargo.
Let me go back to Dr. Rolando Perez Rodriguez. What plans does Cuba have for your vaccines, like Soberano? How do you plan to use it? And as with doctors, do you plan to export this vaccine? And how many people have participated in trials in Cuba?
Okay. We are expecting to get the result of the phase 3 clinical trial by June. So if we have ready the clinical data for the efficacy of this vaccine, we should get an authorization for emergency use for the Cuban regulatory agency. And then we can start the massive immunization program in our country. But in parallel, you know, with this phase 3 clinical trial that involved more than 80,000 people, because Soberana, a candidate vaccine or vaccine candidate, has a clinical trial that should include more than 44,000 people, and the other vaccine, candidate vaccine, Abdala, has a clinical trial that should include 48,000 volunteers. So, but in parallel to this clinical phase 3 clinical trial, we are also making clinical studies at population scale in risk groups, population group. For example, the a healthcare workers, all people that are facing the, you know, the disease directly. And then we, in this personal, medical, doctors, nurses, and employees, we are also now making a clinical study. All this data from phase 3 and the clinical data in this population, a clinical study, that is like a real world, because in that kind of study, you will have not only the efficacy, but also how effective will be the vaccine in somehow stop the viral transmission, not just preventing the disease. We should have enough data by June to have this emergency use authorization from the Cuban regulatory agency.
I want to go to the U.S. administration approach to Cuba. During his campaign, President Biden promised to lift current restrictions on remittances and travel to Cuba. But it remains unclear if he's going to pursue resetting relationships with the island. Last month, White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said a shift in U.S. policy on Cuba is not a priority for Biden, adding his administration is reviewing Trump's designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. This is Biden speaking to a crowd in Broward County, Florida, just days before the 2020 presidential election.
We have to vote for a new Cuba policy as well. This administration approach isn't working. Cuba's no closer to freedom and democracy today than it was 4 years ago. In fact, there are more political prisoners, and secret police are as brutal as ever. And Russia, once again, is a major presence in Havana.
So that was Biden right before the election. Of course, during the Obama-Biden years, they were normalizing relations with Cuba. Reed Brody, we're going to end with you. Reed Lindsey, we're going to end with you. If you can talk about what the effect of these U.S. sanctions has been on Cuba and what it would mean if those sanctions were lifted.
And as I mentioned, Cuba is going through an unbelievable economic crisis. And the sanctions have been absolutely devastating. And they've taken on every part of the Cuban economy. They blocked oil shipments from Venezuela. There was an energy crisis in Cuba. They blocked remittances. If you wanted to send me some money in Cuba, you wouldn't be able to do so. You no longer can send money via Western Union. They basically stopped all investment. They've called Cuba a state sponsor of terror. They stopped all U.S. tourism. Even if there wasn't COVID, there'd be no U.S. tourists coming here. Biden is, although he said that he was going to implement a new Cuban policy, has not shown that he will. And just yesterday, Juan Gonzalez, who is the basically that for the National Security Council that runs point on Latin American policy, told CNN, quote, "Biden is not Obama in Cuba policy." And he said that Biden would, that the administration would not invest the political capital necessary to change policy towards Cuba. The Biden administration is being pressured by powerful Cuban Americans. The Cuban Americans are the chairs of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. They're getting a lot of pressure, and they're just not interested in changing policy. At least so far, they've shown them not. So far, it's status quo as far as policy towards Cuba.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Reed Lindsey, journalist and founder of Belly of the Beast, independent media organization that covers Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations. Also the director of the War on Cuba series, which is executive produced by Danny Glover and Oliver Stone. And Dr. Rolando Perez Rodriguez, the director of science and innovation at BioCuba Pharma. He's also the founder of Cuba's Molecular Immunology Center, member of the Cuban Academy of Science. Coming up, we stay in the Americas. We'll be talking to the director, the Americas director of Amnesty International, about how the pandemic has exacerbated inequality and driven migration north across the hemisphere. Stay with us.
En este casco ruge un silencio plebeyo, como de tropas mambisas, prestas alto que ha de huello. En este bulbo, humedad de amor bravío, Baraguana bella eterno, por lágrimas de dos ríos. En este envase, democracia sin alarde, orgullo para el honesto, vergüenza para el cobarde. En esta dosis, la virgencita de la caridad bendice al bravo David que enfrenta al rudo Goliat. Bendice al bravo David.
En este frasco. The Strength of a Country by Cuban band Buena Fe. The song is dedicated to the Cuban doctors. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to take a look at how the pandemic has exacerbated inequity across the Americas over the past year, over 1.3 million people have died in the Americas from COVID-19, making it the hardest hit region in the world. In the United States, the death toll has topped 560,000. In Brazil, the numbers reached 345,000, with over 4,200 deaths on Thursday alone. In Mexico, the official death toll is 206,000, but the government recently admitted the true number is actually 60% higher. A new report by Amnesty International has found women, refugees, migrants, underprotected health workers, indigenous communities, black people, and other groups historically ignored and attacked by governments have borne the brunt of the pandemic. Amnesty's annual report on human rights paints a devastating picture of injustice across the hemisphere. Mexico is the deadliest country for journalists last year. Amnesty also condemned the rise in gender violence in Mexico, where nearly 3,800 women were killed last year. Nearly 1,000 of the deaths were investigated as femicides. Colombia remains the world's most lethal country for human rights defenders. Here in the U.S., Amnesty cites the police killing of George Floyd and the crackdown on Black Lives Matter protesters, which highlighted the country's deep racial injustice over the past year. Meanwhile, in Brazil, between January and June of last year, police killed more than 3,000 Brazilians, nearly 80% of the victims black. Amnesty also documented the killing of 287 trans and gender nonconforming people across the continent last year. The Amnesty report also looks at the crisis in the Central American nations of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, where thousands have fled to escape state violence and poverty fueled by U.S. intervention, as well as the destruction left behind by two hurricanes that hit the region last year. We go now to Mexico City, where we're joined by Erika Guevara Rosas. She is the Americas Director for Amnesty International. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about your findings? As the United States is most aware of what's happening in Latin America because of what's happening on the border, the situation in these different countries, describe what you found most egregious.
Thanks, Amy. Good morning and good morning to the audience. Yes, our report, our annual report that was presented a couple of days ago, it's a picture of the state of the human rights situation around the world. And in the case of the America, that picture is extremely devastating, as you have just mentioned. Our report shows that COVID-19 pandemic and the measures taken to tackle it had a devastating effect on human rights in the region. I mean, unfortunately, Unfortunately, it's not a surprise that the Americas has been the region worst hit by the pandemic. Pre-existing human rights challenges, such as the growing inequality, corruption, violence, environmental degradation, and impunity, created a fertile ground for the Americas to become the epicenter. You just mentioned the numbers. With only 13% of the population, the Americas continent has 48% of the total COVID deaths. But the impact is not just around the numbers. It is also about the response of the states and how these responses have affected marginalized communities such as indigenous people, Black communities, women, refugee and migrants, and other vulnerable communities that are at risk. And what is very shocking is that not only the COVID has shown some of these pre-existing conditions, these pre-existing human rights challenges, but also the pandemic has exacerbated some of these conditions precisely because of the response of some of the governments. I mean, we've witnessed how some of our leaders have responded to the pandemic with denial, opportunism, and disregard for human rights. Some of our governments in the continent impose certain restrictions using excessive use of force and arbitrary detentions as the only way to impose the restrictions, creating additional crisis to the crisis that we were already facing. And as you mentioned, some of the countries with the numbers not only of COVID, but also the increasing violence that some of these responses, some of the measures imposed by the governments have created. I mean, we've seen the increase in the number of violence against women, increase in the number of cases, feminicides, but also increasing the number of police violence across the continent, sometimes connected or associated to some of the restrictions imposed by the governments.
Talk more about what's happening in Mexico right now. When you talk about the femicides, there have been mass protests against them, and also the killing of journalists.
Well, Mexico is one of the countries that is facing a massive human rights crisis for many years, right? The militarization of the response has been a common characteristic of all the governments, including government of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. I mean, Mexico continues to face a crisis of people who have disappeared. Only this year, the reports are that 82,000 people continue to remain missing in Mexico. And we've seen an increase of the militarization, including at the borders, right, with the National Guard being formalized in terms of their apparatus and how militarization will continue to grow in Mexico. Mexico continues to be the most dangerous country for journalists, is the fourth most dangerous country for human rights defenders, but also is facing an additional pandemic to the COVID-19 pandemic, that is gender violence against women and girls, right? The increasing number of feminicides over the last 5 years is extremely shocking, but also the increasing demand that we are seeing on the streets. Women are taking to the streets, particularly young women and feminist collectives, demanding accountability and demanding a stop in gender violence. And what they've been facing is additional violence by the police, excessive use of force, arbitrary detention. We have received reports of sexual violence against protesters that are taken to the streets. And we've seen also President Andrés López Obrador disregard for the situation that women and girls are facing in the country, reducing the investment into public policy to prevent violence, but also attacking feminist groups and young women who are taken to the streets during their press conference that happen every morning.
On Wednesday, I want to switch to now Honduras, the trial of an alleged mastermind behind the 2016 murder of the award-winning environmentalist Berta Cáceres. That trial was once again delayed. Cáceres was assassinated in her home in La Esperanza a year after she won the Goldman Environmental Prize for her work protecting indigenous communities in her campaign against a massive hydroelectric dam project. The president of the hydroelectric dam company, David Castillo, was set to stand trial this week, but the trial was suspended after his defense team attempted to change the judge. This is the fourth time the trial has been delayed. Earlier this week, Cáceres' daughter, Betita Zuniga Cáceres, spoke at a rally outside the Supreme Court where the trial was supposed to be held. This is what she said.
Sin embargo, bueno, nosotros sabemos que este proceso puede abrir las puertas también.
We know that this process can open the doors for the conclusion of the responsibility of those who paid and ordered the crime. It can also reconstruct the events for us, and because the evidence is convincing and irrefutable, we hope that Mr. Diego Castillo is proven guilty.
Pues dará una sentencia condenatoria para el señor David Castillo. Y tememos que con este proceso
we fear that this process may end the process of seeking the fundamental justice from my mother. That is why today is so important to us. This is the reason we seek justice and punishment for those who are most responsible. We hope for truth, for justice, and to contribute to the guarantee of non-repetition of these crimes, above all, against the territorial leaders who continue to defend the common goods of the nature, the rights of indigenous community. We also hope to break a little the structural impunity that exists in our country that protects those people who are economic and political leaders.
Can you talk about the significance of what's happening and the delays of this trial, what it means for environmental defenders, human rights activists are so under attack in Honduras right now. And at the same time, you have the president, Juan Orlando Hernandez's brother, sentenced to life in prison in the United States for drug trafficking, the president himself a co-conspirator.
Yeah. Well, Latin America and the Caribbean remains the world's deadliest region for human rights defenders, right? Last year in 2020, we recorded 264 killings that represent almost 80% of the total killings of human rights defenders around the world. And Honduras in particular is the third country more lethal for human rights defenders, where human rights defenders are facing attacks, criminalization, and forced disappearance. We denounced the enforced disappearance of Garifuna human rights defenders last year in the hands of the police, right? So Berta Cáceres is not only emblematic of the violence that human rights defenders and environmentalists are facing in the continent, but also the levels of impunity that these cases normally have, the lack of justice, the lack of investigation, intention of delaying any proceedings related to human rights defenders' violence. Berta was killed 5 years ago, and since then, the demand for justice has faced numerous obstacles since day one, right? With the state authorities trying to delay investigation, trying to delay the family to gather information and to get information from the investigation. So this is not new. I mean, all these delays, unfortunately, have been part of this denial for justice in the case of Berta Cáceres. And the family and COPIN have struggled for many years and confronted many threats from attacks, violence, arbitrary detentions. Just Berta's daughters, Berta and Laura, were detained a couple of days before the trial started this week. So these are the constants that we are seeing in Honduras, where impunity remains the norm, where the authorities are not providing protection for those who have been threatened precisely because of the human rights that they are doing. And those who are fighting for right to land and access to their territories and protecting the environment are the ones who are facing even more violence precisely because the government has been prioritizing the interest of the economic powers instead of protecting the human rights defenders that are at the front lines protecting the rights of everyone. So Berta Cáceres continue to be very emblematic. We are observing and monitoring how, the development of this trial will continue. I mean, now with this recourse that was presented by the defendant team, we are expecting that in three days, the court needs to resolve the matter and the trial can continue.
And can you talk about how this country, the United States, sees migration and why people are making their way to the border, so desperate refugees, to leave countries that they love?
Well, as people continue to flee violence, poverty, and the effects of the climate crisis, we've seen not only the United States, but several governments are denying the right of people to seek asylum and denying the right of people to seek protection, right? We've seen, particularly in the context of the pandemic, how migrants and refugees have been detained in many countries across the continent, how asylum seekers have been forcibly returned to the countries where they are facing risk. And the United States, of course, is at the top of the list in terms of violating the rights of migrants and refugees, right? The former administration, the Trump administration, implemented some of the most inhumane and cruel policies around refugees and migrants, with the separation of families, the massive detention of people, the deportation of people, and forcing people to get stuck in the border on the Mexico side in some of the most violent communities across the continent, right? And with the Biden administration, of course, the expectation is huge, given the commitments and the promises during the campaign and some of the efforts that the Biden administration has taken at the beginning of his mandate. But unfortunately, we haven't seen substantial change. People continue to be stuck at the border. We've seen the detention of unaccompanied minor children who continue to be in these temporary facilities under very precarious condition and even exposed to COVID-19 in this period of a lot of alarm that is happening in the United States with the virus as well.
And finally, Etika, if you could comment on the years of U.S. foreign intervention in the countries where most of the refugees are coming from, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, the U.S. support for the militaries and the paramilitary death squads that led to so many deaths in these countries, wreaking havoc in especially the indigenous populations. Can you talk about that as a cause of people today, now, years later, coming to the United States?
Amy, this is a very important question because we need to understand the root causes of why people are leaving and escaping their countries. Most of the people that are coming to the United States come from the Northern Triangle of Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. These are countries where people are escaping generalized violence, the lack of state protection, and sometimes they are escaping from the persecution from the state and the violence that is being perpetrated by the government and the police and the army. And this is all in combination with U.S. intervention. U.S. has been investing in military, you know, support to these countries. The U.S. has reduced investment on aid to provide support for communities to really address the root causes of why people are leaving the countries. The U.S. has feed into, you know, the gaining of the influence of the organized crime because of the weakness of the institutions, of the official institutions. And of course, now we are expecting that the Biden administration is going to have a shift in the way that it is relating with these countries, seeking collaboration, seeking cooperation, but more important, seeking to collaborate to address the root causes that involve U.S. intervention in all these countries.
Etika Guevara Rosas, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Human rights lawyer, America's director for Amnesty International, which has just published its annual report on the state of the world's human rights. Coming up, President Biden has ordered a series of executive actions on gun control, calling gun violence in the U.S. an epidemic and an international embarrassment. We'll get more.
On all good workers, this year is our time. Now there's folks in Washington who care what's on our mind. Which side are you on now? Which side are you on?
DeFranco singing Which Side Are You On? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's ordered a series of executive actions on gun control, calling gun violence in the U.S. an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Biden's orders will crack down on so-called ghost guns, easily assembled firearms bought over the internet without serial numbers, which account for about a third of guns recovered at crime scenes. The executive actions come after deadly mass shootings in Boulder, Colorado, Atlanta, Georgia, one in Rock Hill, South Carolina, Wednesday. Biden called on Congress to pass a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines and said gun manufacturers should be held liable for deaths and injuries resulting from their products.
The only industry in America, a billion-dollar industry, that can't be sued, has exempt from being sued, are gun manufacturers.
We're joined now by Brian Lemick, executive director of Brady Pack. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian. Can you respond to what President Biden has proposed and what you want to see happen?
Thank you, Amy. And I think this is a reminder for all of us that elections matter. President Biden came in and honored his campaign promises with swift executive action to start saving American lives. We are really thrilled with what he was able to put out yesterday. We are encouraged by the ATF director nominee, David Chipman. We are thrilled to see action on the very dangerous ghost guns. We are really encouraged by the amount of lives that could be saved from suicide through the extreme risk protection orders. And we're proud of President Biden and really feeling great about his attention to the issue. We knew that President Biden, having been someone who served with the Brady family, Jim and Sarah back in the early 90s, passed the original Brady background check system to pass the assault weapon ban. So we knew coming in that President Biden would be the gun violence prevention champion we all expected him to be. And now we are calling on Congress to carry the torch here and pass additional laws to keep Americans safe and to save American lives.
And what do you think is most important for Congress to pass right now?
I think that the most important thing for Congress and the most immediate action to save lives is expanding the existing Brady background check system. This is a law that has prevented over 3 million prohibited purchasers since its inception. It's the call to action really for us is for Congress to make a really good law better, to bring it up to the times. We know that when the law was first created, that gun shows weren't the operation that they are today, where the transfer of millions of firearms are occurring every year. We also know that the internet wasn't as robust a market as it is today either. So these are things that could not have been anticipated. And we're asking Congress just to come with the times and make a really good law better.
And what do you make of the other Joe running the government? You've got President Joe Biden, and then you've got Senator Joe Manchin. And what he has proposed, together with the Republican Senator Toomey of Pennsylvania, but many fearing he will be the person who will stand against gun control.
Senator Manchin has demonstrated both a interest in keeping Americans safe, while also not interfering with the Second Amendment. Senator Manchin is a hunter, he's a gun owner, and he's from a state with a rich gun culture. I think that he's a fine example of what the gun violence prevention movement needs to be doing, which is working hand in hand with gun owners, gun enthusiasts, sportsmen, et cetera, to pass life-saving laws. And I think Senator Manchin is someone that can help us do that.
And what about right now, the issue that Biden raised yesterday, the issue of immunity for gun manufacturers, saying it's the only industry in this country that has this level of immunity? What exactly does it mean, and how could it be stripped?
It is probably one of the most dangerous laws that are out there. It's shocking to all of us that the regulations on squirt guns are greater than those on firearms and firearm manufacturers. And really what it is, it's a relic of the days when the NRA actually had power. Now we see them as a toothless organization. And the expectation here is rules such as those can be turned over. We know that the NRA has put pressure on lawmakers for many years. They are the political arm of the gun manufacturing industry. And we know that now with President Biden, with a gun violence prevention majority in the House and the Senate, with the overwhelming majority of Americans supporting common sense gun legislation, that we can apply the political pressure to change those laws, to keep Americans safe, and to stop letting the gun manufacturers get away with effectively murder.
And Biden acknowledging gun violence in black and brown communities across the country and promising funds to community violence prevention programs. We've got 10 seconds.
President Biden is just demonstrating that there's comprehensive solutions to this very complex problem. That includes community, addressing suicide, addressing domestic violence, and just addressing the everyday gun violence that communities of color experience.
I want to thank you, Brian Lemick, Executive Director of Brady Pack. That does it for our show. A happy early birthday to David Prude. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. You can learn more and apply today at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras, our general managers, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.